This episode of the Real Fit Podcast is brought to you by the Real Nourished newsletter. Real Nourished, reinventing your relationship with food, is for you if you are ready to stop micromanaging your food and exercise so you can start fully showing up to your life. Each biweekly issue features evidence-based tools that will help reduce your food-related anxiety, improve your body image, and help you embrace exercise as a form of nourishment, not punishment. When you subscribe, you'll get my free guide, 11 things you can do right now to feel better about your body. To get in on it, just click on the link in the show notes or visit my website, pam-moore.com. Hey, and welcome to the Real Fit Podcast, a show featuring candid conversations with women athletes on topics including body image, enoughness, and so much more. I'm your host, Pam Moore, and I'm an occupational therapist turned intuitive eating coach and journalist. And I created this podcast to let you know that you're already enough. Thank you so much for being here. If you have questions about perimenopause, menopause, or how you can eat what you want without adhering to any rules and still perform well as an athlete, do not go anywhere. This episode was made just for you. Today, I have the one and only Celine Yeager. She's the host of the Hit Play Not Pause podcast, which is phenomenal if you haven't listened yet. She's the content manager at Feisty Menopause and a best-selling professional health and fitness writer. Some of her many, many, many titles include Roar and Next Level, which she co-authored with Dr. Stacey Sims. In short, Celine Yeager is an expert in all things pertaining to midlife women athletes, and she lives what she writes as an NASM certified personal trainer, a PN1 certified nutrition coach, off-road racer, and former All-American Ironman triathlete. In this interview, Celine discusses her history with an eating disorder, and please consider this your content warning. She gets into some pretty graphic detail, and also how she ultimately healed her relationship with food. Celine gets into the evolution of her career as an athlete, how she's come to embrace gravel biking and bikepacking, and how both her approach to training and her outlook on sports have changed since going through menopause. And I don't know about you, but almost everything I hear about perimenopause and menopause makes me dread it. But after talking to Celine, I feel unexpectedly hopeful, and I'm pretty sure you will too. Celine also shares some beautiful insights on how a perimenopausal mom and an adolescent daughter can not just survive, but thrive while living in the same household. And you'll definitely want to listen all the way through to the end for that amazing little gem. I really hope you love this conversation as much as I did. Without further ado, let's dive right in. Thank you for joining us, Celine. How are you today?
I am very well. The humidity broke in Pennsylvania. It was pretty oppressive here. The weather's just spectacular.
So. That's awesome.
That always lifts everyone's mood.
Absolutely. Where in Pennsylvania are you?
I am in Emmaus, Pennsylvania, which is a little town by Allentown, Bethlehem, Easton, sort of like north of Philly and south of New York City.
I spent a lot of time as a kid in Waynesboro, which is...
Oh, I know Waynesboro.
I don't really know where it is in relation to Philly, but that's where my grandparents lived.
Yeah. Yeah. It's west.
We used to go to Hershey Park every summer. That was like the highlight of my young life.
Yeah. 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 The super duper looper.
Okay. How is Pennsylvania for gravel biking? Because I've seen a lot of your
posts
lately.
It's amazing.
Tell me more.
What is really beautiful about it, like we have a lot of state forests, and they're especially around like that area that you were talking about, like Hershey, the center of the state, you know, the Grand Canyon of Pennsylvania is out that way. And my husband puts on a gravel event actually called Unpaved of the Susquehanna River Valley. And the thing is that they're not gravel roads in that many people have come to think of gravel like that chunky, difficult gravel that you might find in the Midwest. It's more like hard dirt roads that also don't turn to clay. So they're okay when they're wet. Some of them are just nicer than pavement, almost like a lovely Velcro kind of dirt that you can just fly on. Really, really beautiful, fun.
Oh, wow.
Riding.
That sounds lovely.
And this time of year is like tunnels of green. Like, so we don't have a lot of vistas. We have some, but you're just surrounded by this like technicolor green that is just really cool.
I feel like you've captured that in your Instagram posts. I see them. And I'm like, oh, I want to go.
Yeah.
Where I'm at, there's some dirt roads. I'm here in Colorado, and there's like some trails. And like, unlike you, I do not come from a mountain bike background. I'm more of a road biker. So I can be very intimidated by some of the more technical terrain, but it sounds like what you're describing is not technical. It's just away from cars and beautiful.
Exactly.
I want that. So, all right. Yeah, go ahead.
Just the last thing on that, because I do, you know, I wrote for bicycling for like 27 years. I still contribute sometimes. When I got people into gravel, the thing that I was really conscious about was, even if you come from a mountain biking background, like descending on gravel can be terrifying for anybody who is not used to it, because it's generally like loose stuff over hard pack. And that's like the hardest thing to control a bike on. So you really have to learn about tire pressures and tires and weight and all that. It's not as simple as just like putting your bike down a hill and going, wee. But anyway.
Yeah, no, it sure is. Oh, actually, that reminds me. I wanted to ask you, do you live near the Runner's World Bicycling Magazine headquarters?
Like a mile away.
So what happened first? Yeah. Did you move there and get the job all those years ago? Or did you get the job?
I moved for the job.
Okay.
Yep. And then met all my family. And like, I met my husband, met all my friends. We all got hired about the same time and we're all still here.
That's really cool. You don't really think of Pennsylvania as like a hub for athletes, but clearly if you work at bicycling, it is.
This area really is, because bicycling, Runner's World, Backpacker at the time was here, Mountain Bike when it was its own magazine. We also have the Truckstertown Velodrome. Mm-hmm. That's like world-class. People come, that's 8 miles away. It's a strange little bubble for very high performance athletes here.
That's very cool. How many velodromes are there in the U.S.? Do you know?
Less than a dozen, I think. Not many.
Yeah, I feel like if anybody would know that obscure fact, it would be you.
I should know more. I'm not much of a track racer, but it is not many. It's around that number.
Okay. So, and I kind of jumped the gun. We kind of veered off into the gravel thing because it felt right. But 99% of the time, I start the show by asking my guests to tell me a little bit about your background as an athlete and your relationship with movement and your body and fitness and your weight and all that good stuff, how it's evolved.
Well, those are huge, many myriad questions. So I know. Let me just take the like active part.
Yeah.
Because I always was a very active kid. I am still like most comfortable when I'm in motion. And I think I was always that way. I was always just outside on my bike, on my skateboard, on my scooter, whatever, just playing with friends. And I always rode a bike in my flip-flops to the lake just to see if I could. I didn't know people race bike. I grew up in a very small town in coal country, Pennsylvania. I just didn't know anything. I just did what I did. And it wasn't until way, 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 way later, once I was out of college even, that I found out that people raced bicycles and there were all these things. And that's where I discovered that I had this athletic person that I didn't even know existed. I mean, I played field hockey and stuff in school, but I would have never branded myself as a quote unquote athlete.
Yeah. Was there one race or event or ride where the switch kind of flipped and you were like, oh, I'm good at this, or I'm an athlete, or I could see myself doing a lot more of this?
There were a couple. I mean, I got signed up for a road race here. I started riding with the people when I moved to this part of Pennsylvania to work at Rodale, which was the parent company of all those magazines. And everyone's like, oh, you should ride, because everyone like rode at lunch and did lunch rides. So I bought a bike. They had a in-house Craigslist almost. So I bought this cheap bike and, you know, I'm riding with them and they're like, you should consider racing. And I was like, I don't even know what that is. And I signed up and I won the first road race, but I was like, I don't know, that was okay. And then they're like, we should try mountain biking. And I signed up for a mountain bike race and I won that. And I was like, okay, like there's probably something here. And again, I never took it very seriously, but I did think, oh, this is fun. And it's fun to be good at something and, you know, pursue it that way.
Yeah, that totally builds on itself, right? The liking, the being good at it and just do more and more. How did you start working at bicycling if you didn't have a background as a cyclist?
I was a trainer. So I was like trained in personal training, sports training. And I was a writer, and I knew enough about, because I had come up sort of riding a bike, so I knew the fundamentals. And they were like, well, you should consider writing. They had a fitness column at the time. And I was like, okay, I'll do some of your fitness and training content, because that was kind of an easy leap for me. And then I really liked it. And I went on to get a coaching certification. And as I sort of developed as a cyclist, I developed within the magazine as well.
Okay. I don't remember what podcast it was, but I heard you say on a podcast that you got more into triathlon, but tell me if I got this right. You were more of a triathlete and later raced bikes, or was it vice versa?
It was a little bit, that's fair. When I got serious, you're correct. In my late 20s, you know, when I was at Rodale, just messing around, jumping into races and having fun, I was mostly riding a bike. I would occasionally do like a 5K, maybe a 10K. I did not swim. And then triathlon was popular at the time. If you remember like the late 90s, early 2000s, it was really sort of taking off. Mm-hmm. A lot of the people that were in my circles were just doing it. And it looked like, it's like, I don't know if I could do that. I don't know if I could swim, but it looked really inviting. It looked fun. And it's something that I would want to try. We had access to a Olympic distance pool that employees could use in the morning three times a week. So I started swimming okay enough to just sign up for a sprint triathlon. And I really liked it. It was just really fun. And so I just started doing those for fun. And it wasn't until I was in my late 30s, I was like 38, when I came across an article that said like 16 weeks to Ironman. And I was like, oh, just so silly to think about now. Something that I would have written at the time, yeah. Right? Like those headlines.
Yeah.
And I was like, oh, I could do 16 weeks of anything, you know, to Ironman. At that point, I'd been doing a lot of bike racing and just big events. But I did not know how to swim. I was very intimidated by swimming that distance. Like I could always get out of the water, but I was always... everybody says that, but it's true. I was very close to the end. I was not a good swimmer. I started reading the 16 weeks to Ironman and I couldn't understand any of the swim workouts. They looked like hieroglyphics to me. I was just like, what does this mean? So I thought I should hire a swim coach. And I called this woman, Erica, and I said, can you help me swim? And she's like, I'd be great to help you swim. And she's like, my husband, Craig, is a Ironman coach. So you could hire us both. And I was like, oh, okay. And he had me do the whole intake thing where I sent a bunch of my results and all this and that. And he immediately called and he's like, you could qualify for Kona with your bike times. And I just was like, I don't really think I wanted to hear that. But 16 weeks became 10 or 11 months. And it worked. I qualified. I won my age group at Louisville at 39 and went to Kona 6 weeks later.
That's amazing.
And then shortly after that, a regional mountain bike team, which was mostly women, picked me up. And I spent that's where you're hearing that. Like okay. I went from that big level of triathlon and I got picked up by this mountain bike racing team and did that at a very high level for the next 5 to 7 years.
Okay. As you continued to do mountain biking at a high level, were you still a full-time journalist?
Oh yeah. No, I never stopped that.
Okay. And I need to know, because you co-wrote Next Level with Stacey Sims and you're all about the heavy weightlifting, were you doing any weightlifting back then as part of your triathlon and or mountain bike training?
Not heavy. That wasn't in the ethos at that time.
True.
You know, I mean, people just weren't, I never had picked up a barbell. I was always an extremely muscular woman. I mean, if you look back at some pictures, people wouldn't believe that I wasn't lifting. Like, my dad was a bodybuilder. I was like, just from the technical mountain biking, I was really, really strong. But I would always be in the gym throughout, especially the off season, just to sort of get a base of like your core strength and doing some lifting. I always did a lot of bodyweight stuff. I would do push-ups and pull-ups and, you know, some squats and that kind of thing, but never heavy lifting because it just wasn't part of the repertoire until quite a bit later that people, endurance athletes started adopting that.
Yeah, we weren't talking about that back then.
They were told not to. I think back, I'm like, it would have made so much more sense to lift that way than that sort of like 10 to 12 repetition of nothing. It's fine, but you don't need that. You don't, as an endurance athlete, especially, it doesn't make a lot of sense.
Yeah, well, I want to definitely come back to that. But I understand you did the Happy Valley 70.3. Was that in June?
I did. So it was July 2nd.
July 2nd. Okay, so how did you come back to triathlon?
You know, when I saw it, I didn't even do the math to be like, wow, it had been 15 years because time sure does fly. Because 2008 was when I went to Kona and I had not done another one. I just had no interest. And then I was doing so much stage racing, it just fell by the wayside. And I would never, ever, ever do another full. I don't like running enough to run 26 miles ever again, especially on pavement. It's just too far. But the last couple of years, I have been feeling like, I'd look at the bike because I still have the bike. I would look at it, be like, I'm feeling a little two-dimensional or one-dimensional. I lift and I ride, but there was not a whole lot of purpose and I wasn't feeling super excited about anything, you know, because I've done a bunch of stuff and all the big races and events that I've wanted to do. And I thought I could try another triathlon. It would be kind of fun to just dip my toes, but nothing caught my eye. And then we still get the local paper because I have a bunch of friends who are in journalism and I have to support our local paper. And I'm kind of glad I do because I find out about stuff like this. Like I saw that there was going to be a 70.3, an inaugural race in Happy Valley, Pennsylvania. And that is my alma mater. I went to Penn State.
Okay.
And I saw, oh, it finishes on the 50-yard line of Beaver Stadium. And I don't know if people know football or not, but like Penn State's a big football school and Beaver Stadium is astronomically big. It holds like 100,000 people. The place is insanely, insanely large. And you're not allowed in it. Like, even as a student, you're never allowed in that stadium. It's always locked outside of game time. So I thought, that sounds really fun. And then I read more about it and it was going to be a point-to-point, which I also think is kind of cool. Like, the whole thing just sounded really cool. And the ride was in like Amish country and it's rolling hills. So it's what I'm used to. And I just like that. I didn't think much more than that. I registered that day and I thought I can 100% train up for a half. It's enough to be scary, but not too much to like make me miserable.
Yeah.
That's how I got back into that.
About how many months did you dedicate to training, like in earnest, specifically for the 70.3?
I started in earnest in December swimming.
Okay.
Swimming and running specifically. Because A, it was a good time to swim. It's like Pennsylvania wintertime is hit or miss, but it's nice to have something to do. I don't really train indoors, so if it's nasty and being out trying to run and ride, it's kind of hard. So I'm like, getting back in the pool sounds perfect. And I wanted to give myself a lot of time to get back into running, to get up to 13 miles of running, especially on pavement. I had only really been trail running and not more than maybe 4 miles. And I wanted to really give myself that time to properly build myself up so this was going to be a good experience.
Yeah, I love that. And was it a good experience?
It was a great experience. It was great on every single level. Like, I got everything I wanted out of it. Like, at some point, there was just like a moment when I went out for a long run that I was like, oh, I feel like I could run forever. My mind is wandering instead of going, how much longer do I need to run? Like, when you get back into running, if you haven't done it, it's not forgiving. It was a few months, but there was at some point where I was like, oh, this is what I was seeking. Like, I really love this feeling of just being like, I could just run all day. This is a great feeling. The swim was the same thing. When I got into the water and I remembered that body awareness and the catching of the water, and I thought, like, this is what I was seeking, and everything else at that point is going to be just icing on the cake.
Yeah. After so many years away from the sport, did it kind of have the feel of going in almost as a beginner? Almost like that first love kind of freshness?
It did, yeah, it did in a way. Like, especially since, you know, I did hire a coach, like I had mentioned. And whenever you have a new coach, there's almost that experience because people come at the coach. And I like that. I really like trying a new coach. And I really liked Marnie Sunball. Try Marnie. She was amazing. But she had me doing a lot of, there were so many toys in the pool, like snorkels and buoys and straps. And I had never done any of that. So that was all new to me, which was pretty cool. And then the running, definitely I had that new love feeling because she had me doing like hill repeats and I like hill work. It was fun. I enjoyed opening up training peaks and being like, oh, what are we doing today? There was enough familiarity that I knew what I was doing. So it wasn't daunting, but that it was fresh and exciting all at the same time.
I love that. And I love that you shared with me, and for my listeners, I will share with you in the show notes a link to the article you wrote for Bicycling in 2015 about like your body image journey and the difficult relationship you've had with food, which I think will resonate with a lot of listeners. I don't know if it's too bold to say, but I think body image issues are inextricably linked with womanhood. And
I think that's fair.
I hate to say it, but I think it's true. What did it feel like to go into this 70.3 compared with where you were in your journey with food and body stuff back in your 20s? And if you'll just like give like a brief recap for listeners who probably haven't read the article or know your history.
Yeah, I mean, it's an interesting question because when I did Ironman in 2008, I was also in a good place like that. You know, okay. I've come up and down out of good and bad places. I, you know, just for the big arc of it for people listening, I was always a very big kid in class and what you would call a chubby kid, I guess. I just remember that my pediatrician gave my mom a diet to put me on when I was 8. Like that's Ooh. When I, that that's when I remember. And I remember like we used to have to step on the scale in, at school in front of everybody. Do they still do that? I don't need like
my kids. I never did that. Maybe it depends on the region. We didn't do that.
My God.
My kids do not do that. And I would be raising hell if they did.
We lined up and like You know, and then the nurse would like read it out loud. Like it was sort of like torture. And I weighed like 88 pounds. I remember that. And I don't know how old I was. But I was in elementary school. So, you know, I remember like the boy behind me making a big deal. It was just the whole thing. But, you know, it was definitely learning that I was supposed to diet. And coming up, you know, this is the 70s, 80s, where everything was about being as thin and blonde as you could possibly be. And I was neither. I developed a tumultuous relationship, I guess, with my body at that point. And that high school was okay. I played field hockey. I sort of stayed on top of it. But like I got to college and I was which happens often, like you go off and like all of a sudden your ground is shifting under your feet. And I was just trying to grab control. And everybody was telling me about the freshman 15. And it was just like not a good time in my life. And I wasn't really riding my bike or doing the things that used to ground me. And I just developed a really bad eating disorder. I became bulimic and anorexic. And I got down to very close to 100 pounds, which is hard for me to even. I don't even know how that could be, because I'm probably 30 pounds lighter than I am now. My hair was falling out. I mean, it was just the whole thing. I know my mother was gravely worried about me. And but I got straight A's. So, I mean, she didn't feel like, you know, she's like, she must be OK, which I was not obviously OK. It might be a little bit triggering, but I will share that. One of the moments that turned me around, and I wrote about it in that piece, I used to make myself vomit and you can take this out if it's too graphic, but with a toothbrush. There was one time and I was at the college dorms, and it was between classes and nobody was there, and the toothbrush slipped out of my hand and got lodged in my throat. And I literally thought, this is how I'm going to die. Like, this is how. And, you know, I just thought about my mom and my dad, and I was like, oh my God. And I managed to sort of get it out. And I would love to say that it ended right there, but it sure did. Sort of something clicked in my mind. And I was like, I've got to get my shit straight. And I was, you know, with a kind of an abusive boyfriend. I was having lots of troubles with just knowing who I was. Bit by bit, I got rid of the abusive relationship. I got back on the bike. I got sort of grounding and finding myself. And it honestly, Pam, it sort of went away the same way it came. Just sort of bit by bit of finding myself and centering myself back in things that I was good at.
Yeah.
And but that never goes away. Any stressful times in your life, you're always just sort of not seeing yourself and leaning back into that. Oh, if I was thinner, or oh, if I was lighter. And when you get into sports, I mean, you get complimented when you lose weight or when you look quote unquote fit. So there was some up and down for most of my life, I would say, where I'd always be trying to eat as little as I could and get away with it, you know, like,
oh, yeah.
But when I was training for Ironman, I mean, you're so hungry and there's so much going on. Like I felt like I was in a pretty good eating pattern there. Yeah. But then even then, at some point I would start sliding and be like, oh, maybe I shouldn't have carbs, or maybe just in and out of those head spaces. And it hasn't been until very recently that has honestly gone away.
First of all, thank you for being so candid. And second, my ears kind of perked up when you mentioned that you were in a bad relationship and that you didn't really like know who you were. You know, you had mentioned I like the turn of phrase, like the ground shifting underneath you, because that definitely resonates for me going to college and not knowing what the hell was going on and thinking like, oh, it feels like everybody else has like 18 best friends and I don't, you know, really, the isolation you wrote about in the bicycling piece, I really related to that. But I think you alluded to the fact that it's not necessarily about food. It's about knowing yourself and not being sure of who you are. Like for me, a lot of the food stuff is about thinking that I need to be a certain way. I need to check XYZ box to feel belonging, to feel love, to feel like an actual quote unquote athlete, you know? And it's like, none of that has to do with who I am inside and knowing myself and being okay with who I am. It's all about what I think other people expect of me. And it's this disconnect between who you are and who you think you're supposed to be. For me, a big shift happened when it was like, no, I'm actually supposed to be exactly who I am, if I can just figure out who that is. Right.
That's a big thing, I think, for a lot of people, honestly, because yeah. I mean, you're living for whatever this image that you think the world expects of you, or you want the world to expect of you. I mean, it's hard to even, but really just listening to. It's hard. I mean, you have to, it starts with, I think, finding yourself. And that is like a life's journey for a lot of people, right? Like it is a big thing. And then being able to tune in and be like, oh, you know, this is what I need, and being able to like recognize what your body needs. And it's so difficult because people all immediately will say, oh, I would just eat ice cream and chips all day or whatever. And I'm like, that you actually wouldn't.
No.
Like, you know what I mean? Like, you really, you know what you want? You wouldn't. When I was binging on things, it's because I was so rigorously keeping everything, you know, it was all about control, 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 control. And then at some point you lose that control and you go sailing off the rails. But if you just take off those guardrails and just be like, I'm going to honestly have what I want. You really don't want ice cream and chips all day. Like, you just don't.
That's totally true. Somebody, I forget who it was, I heard somebody describe it like a seesaw, which I think is an awesome visual. When you're up here with the control and you're down here with the permission, when you do give your, you eat like the one piece of cake, now it becomes an entire cake or two cakes because you're looking for that equilibrium and you were like up here. When you find the equilibrium, you're just like, yeah, I can have it. You don't crave it as bad. Our bodies want equilibrium and they're smarter than us. It's not that we're like addicted to food. It's that we said we couldn't have it. So it feels like we're addicted to it.
Yeah. Yeah. There's a lot. And often we're probably really hungry.
Yes. Yes. <know? laughs>
Like there's that element too. I have started eating a much bigger breakfast every day. And I'm like, wow, I feel so much better. Because it just starts my day. And then I'm not at 10 o'clock. I'm actually not hungry. It holds me over until lunchtime. I'm going to ride. I'm like, what a novel concept.
You know,
like, feed yourself. And then I'm going to like actually eat another meal and it will be fulfilling. And I will be not hungry at 2 in the it shouldn't be a revelation, but it sure feels like one.
Well, I think it feels that way because we, and no shade to journalists, because we both are journalists.
No, so
much of the media has told us, and not just media, but also like actual supposed experts are demonizing eating at any point other than for biological hunger. I don't know about you, but I feel like food is so many things. Food is celebration. Food can be mourning. And of course, food shouldn't be a Band-Aid for all your emotions, but like it's totally okay to eat, even if you're not starving.
Yeah, it 100% is. And I will also say, like, when you are hungry, you should eat, like, you know, and like satisfy that hunger. And there's so many problems, but we are very steeped in diet. Like, diet culture is synonymous with culture, right? So yeah, it's so hard to even get away from it.
It really is. And I appreciate that you said, you know, it was that the eating disorder sort of the healing was a lot like how the onset, in that it was gradual and there were setbacks and there were progress. Cause I think, I don't know, I never want to convey the message that like, oh, I found intuitive eating and now I'm fixed. Now I'm good.
Right.
It's like, I have some good days, I have some bad days, but there's more good days than bad days. What is it for you? You mentioned that like things are feeling better now, like your relationship with food is markedly better now. What do you think is different now than before?
Well, just like I was saying, I don't try to eat according to the least I can eat. I eat what I need. I am an active person. I exercise or train every single day. I wake up hungry. And I was always slightly underfueling myself. I spend a lot of time talking about low energy availability for this audience that I talk to in the menopause transition. And at some point, I'm like, are you eating enough? And I thought, I bet I'm actually not. You know, why must you only have one piece of bread in the morning? Where did that come from? Is it real? You know, and it's amazing what happened when I let myself have two. Like, I just felt so much better. I'm like, okay, like, what have we learned? It's okay. Why don't you have two pieces of toast with your avocado and eggs and all the other. And I felt like my energy was so much better. My mood was so much better. And the training was so much better. I'm like, okay, don't be an idiot and slide back. Let yourself have two pieces of toast. And then like, let's look at lunch. And I also started doing some experiments where on Fridays, I would just, and I didn't call it like a cheat day. I just called it a like, what happens if you actually just eat anything you want day? And you know what? I didn't like gain weight and I didn't go out of control and I felt really good. And I thought, maybe you're on to something. Maybe you should do this every day. It was really just, it was really just that. It was sort of like taking my own advice and imagine how that, well, that works, you know, like when you actually
I love that. I love the idea of like just being curious and treating it as an experiment. I'm just going to try this and see what happens. You know, forget about everything I've been told. Forget about this mental block around the one piece of bread, which I think is highly relatable. Like one of the biggest changes for me since I became an intuitive eater is my energy. I do think my energy is better because I always have two breakfasts. Like I'm a morning worker outer, so I'll do a little breakfast before the workout and then another one after. But I used to think toast was off limits. And I freaking love toast. I love toast with butter. I don't want it with the coconut oil. I don't care if it's like healthy. I want it with the butter. And I'm just happier. Like it's a treat. Every day with my coffee, I eat my toast with butter and I'm happy. And I'm like, well, if that's bad, then I don't want to be good.
Amen.
Anyways, I mean, we could talk about food like forever, but I know there's at least one listener, probably lots of listeners going, okay, that's lovely, but I'm trying to be the best athlete I can be. And I know I'm going to ride up my hills faster or sprint through finish lines faster, whatever sport, you know, if there's any, you know, rock climbing, anything where there's power to weight ratio that's relevant. What if I gain weight and I'm slower? Then what, Celine? Well, then what, Pam? What would you say?
I would say there are two sides to that equation and everyone ignores the second one. Everyone ignores the power side because I have done that experiment, speaking of being curious. So like during that Ironman time when I was in a pretty good place, I did this experiment where I weighed myself every day for, I think it was about a year just to see. And it's amazing how much your weight fluctuates. Mm-hmm. I could go up and down 8 pounds literally overnight. You know, a lot of that's water, it's retention, it's all that stuff. I mean, weight is not just fat and muscle. It's lots of stuff, right? But I also discovered that I had some of my best results 8 pounds heavier than what I would have had in my head as my quote unquote race weight, which was a big thing at the time.
Yeah.
Because fueled athletes go faster. And that's come up a lot. If you go into like a lot of the current conversation, I'm blanking on her name, but there's a British mountain biker that ran into that. She was like, oh, because she's just built strong. You know, she's not a waif, but she could climb and she was good, but she just got in her head, like, I got to lose weight. And in cycling, that's in the, you know, it sort of surrounds you too in the air. And she just was breaking down and not doing well. And she allowed herself to eat and she's now climbing better again. Your performance, that number is just part of it. It's part of a larger picture. You must be fueled to have energy, to have power, and work on your power. There are ways to work on the power. It's not all about getting, as you know, always working on that lighter part. Yes, there's, to a certain point, that's not irrelevant, but it's not the whole story. Everybody makes it the whole story.
Thank you. I love that. So crystal clear. So great. Speaking of building the power, this segues into a listener question. I'm going to meld her question with my specific question. Her question was like, what's kind of a typical week of training looking like for you these days? And my question is, like, I read Next Level. I'm on board for heavy lifting. I got super into it this winter, especially after early fall and summer. I had some issues and I realized, okay, this is my 44-year-old body telling me I can't keep doing things the way I've always done them, which is sporadically strength training, if at all. So I got in the gym. I got in there with a barbell. I was feeling amazing. I even entered the cycling season this spring feeling amazing. I was like, wow, I barely rode indoors this winter and I feel amazing, so strong. But now that it's summer and I just want to be outside, I'm like an all or nothing girl. I'm like, oh, I'm not going in the gym. So I haven't touched a dumbbell or a barbell since probably mid-May, if then. So I'm like, maybe next summer I'll try to figure out like the lifting with all the biking. How do you stay consistent?
I let it be organic too.
Oh.
And I'm very public about that. So I do try to stay 100% in the winter and then the shoulder seasons, you know, like in the winter, I'm definitely lifting the most because that makes the most sense. And I'm doing maybe 2 days a week in the shoulder seasons. But in June, July, and August, I am not doing as much lifting 100%. I'm doing the bare minimum because I want to be outside too.
Yeah,
I can't get away with nothing. I wish I could. But like, literally, it'll go to like 1 day a week of maintenance.
One day a week.
And that's 1 day a week of maintenance.
Like 45 minutes maybe? Or
oh, yeah, totally.
Okay.
Yeah. Maybe two. I'll split it to 20-20.
But, do you try to do that after a hard session so that the following day you can have a nice, easy day?
Yeah, I always try to bundle that bending because I want to respect recovery. And if you try to like spread that stuff out, it's harder to get in that actual true recovery day.
Yeah.
So it is 100% easier to like buddy those two things up.
Okay. All right. Thanks. I appreciate that. Yeah. And what are you training for now? And what does your training look like?
Obviously, I did that whole build up to the 70.3, which was very structured training according to a coach. So I was swimming three, sometimes four times a week, running probably 3 to 4 times a week. Same with a cycling, just butting that stuff up.
Yep.
Right now I'm getting ready for a bikepacking trip that I'm taking at the end of August, which I am also respecting in kind of the same way, because even though I could ride that distance off the couch easily, I don't know how much my bike weighs with all that stuff on it. I don't think I actually want to know. It's not productive to know, but I want my tissues to be ready for that. I don't want to have some random knee issue halfway through it because I didn't train my body to push like a heavier bike for a longer period of time. Oh,
that reminds me of what I wanted to say earlier. I'm just going to inject it right here for listeners. I love what you said about like doing the experiment about the weight, but I would just like to caveat, tell me if you agree with this. I don't think weighing yourself every day is for everybody. Like if it's going to trigger you.
I mean, yeah.
Like,
no.
Like just know if it's healthy for you or not. Like, I don't know if I could do that, but like you have to decide if that is going to work for you.
I was in a good headspace and it was not problematic for me. I have not weighed myself since before the pandemic. So we're going on 3 years.
Yeah.
Like, and I probably will never weigh myself again. And I go to the doctor's office and I say, I don't do scales.
You know, I let them do it in kilograms and then I don't ask for the conversion because I'm not good at that. I have to like, get out my calculator for that. So I'm like, okay, fine. We know the kilograms.
Yeah. I just know. I mean, and there's really no reason to. Like, you're going to know if you've really lost a bunch of weight or if you've gained a bunch of, you know, if there's a health issue impacting your weight, you are going to know that. Like, that's not going to be. So I guesstimate for them and I just let it be. Because I did go through, you know, like that perimenopausal period. I had like a fluctuation period where my muscle did seem to go away overnight and everything was shifting and it was messing with my head. And I'm like, that was not a good time to start. Like, I'm going to get on the scale every day. Like, that would have been a terrible idea for me. And then it was just like super liberating to not even think about weight at all. And then I'm like, it doesn't even matter. Again, I probably will never weigh myself again. I wouldn't recommend. That was just a thought experiment that I was able to do in a very, very grounded place. But I don't recommend that.
Yeah. Okay, awesome. All right. And actually, I'm glad you mentioned menopause and perimenopause because you are the perimenopause / menopause queen. I mean, between like personal experience, the books you've written, the journalism you do, the podcast, everything, like you are the woman. As far as I can tell from everything I've read and heard from you, we are all going to go through it very differently. Yeah. Is there any advice that's universal that can probably help every woman or most women?
Yeah, I mean, I think the biggest, you know, and I started the podcast in 2020 and worked on Next Level around the same time. And I learned an awful, awful lot. I mean, because everybody will go through it pretty much differently, but most people will have some level of symptoms that they will find disruptive in their lives. That is true.
That is true.
And that is
true. Did you say for most or for all?
Most, and it's the vast majority, will find some level of disruption in their lives. It's a minority that will just sort of like, quote unquote, skate through without some. And it doesn't have to be a huge disruption, but you do lose muscle mass and that is disruptive. Body composition changes can be very distressing for women. The hot flashes, the sleep disturbances, when your hormones, those hormones have receptors on every single cell almost. And when they start to do that very wild fluctuation during perimenopause and then start to flatline, it does impact every body system. You know, how well your body weans, how well it adapts, that's a very individual thing. That's what Next Level is all about, picking up where those hormones have left off and doing some of the jobs for them so it's not as disruptive. There's also hormone therapy, which is safe. I think the thing I would say is there are women who are like, their lives are literally very disrupted. They can't sleep. They're getting hot flashes all the time. They have anxiety. Their joints hurt. I mean, it can be, and this is not for everybody, so everybody shouldn't sit there going, oh my God, what am I heading into? But if you find yourself in that place, by all means, find yourself a menopause certified practitioner. You can do that at menopause.org. and see a doctor and talk to them about therapy, because what they're discovering and what nobody was talking about when I started this just 3 years ago is that that level of symptomology and disruption is linked to chronic disease later on, is linked to heart problems, is linked to, so it's whatever is happening, it's a very chicken and egg thing that people can't parse out exactly right now, but it is 100% worth addressing it, because it's not just huffing it out. It's good for your health, your mental and physical and long-term health, to take care of symptoms if they are like that. Don't suffer. There's absolutely no need.
Thank you. I feel like I was seeing it every single time I turned on my computer, looked at my phone, somebody was sending me or sharing the link to the, I mean, it's not recent, maybe it's 6 months old, that article. Was it a New York Times article, that investigative piece in the Sunday magazine that was all about how everything we thought we knew about hormone replacement therapy and how bad it was for you was wrong. And it was based on faulty data. It was funny because I mentioned it to my husband. I'm like, oh, you've heard of da-da-da. Like, I just sort of took it for granted that he had heard of it because I'd been hearing about it like crazy. And he was like, wait, what are you talking about? I'm like, oh yeah, you're on like software Twitter. And I'm on like female athlete Twitter. It's very different.
Very different. Yeah. And what I'll say about that, Pam, is that the pendulum has this way of swinging. Like before that big study, the Women's Health Initiative, which was in the early 2000s, sort of got everyone scared off of hormone therapy. And the big flaw of that study is that it was done on much older women. And they were looking to see if it could prevent those chronic diseases I was talking about. So the average age of those women was like 63. And we do know now that if you initiate hormone therapy, if you put hormones back into your system after your body has weaned off of it and has already started maybe some atherosclerosis or some disease process, it's problematic.
Okay.
If you introduce them when your body already has them in the system, it's just a whole different ballgame. And that's what we have learned from that time. And that's what that article was referencing about, like, everything that we got scared of was wrong. It was just presented
wrong. It didn't apply to us as we're going 100%. Through it. It's 100%. That was for the women who had been through it. If you're in the middle of it or the beginning of it, don't wait.
And that's why they still say, like, most women within 10 years of menopause before 60 years old, benefits outweigh risks. That is sort of the classic take-home message that the scientists are saying now, that the Menopause Society is saying now. The problem is that, in my mind, is that we're swinging very far in the other direction. Before that big scary study, like, there were people literally saying, we should put hormones in the water. And there was this book out called Feminine Forever, what they called menopause like a living decay. Oh, you know, this terrible, terrible language. But I hear some things going back in that direction. Like almost calling menopause a disease process. And I just find that really, really offensive. It's this natural thing. I personally have found it like a really empowering time of my life. I'm not on hormone therapy. I don't deserve a crown for that. It's not a virtue signal. It's just I didn't need it and I'm fine. Yeah. If I did, I'd be on it, you know, but like this is getting sort of promoted as this way to like protect your brain, protect your heart, everything, you'll be healthy forever. And the science isn't there. The recommendations are not for preventative care, really, unless you have a risk for osteoporosis, and then it can help prevent. It is FDA approved for that. It's good for bone health, especially for women. But I just worry that there's so much predatory marketing towards women, and we're just back in that space where the menopause and perimenopause population is enormous and we are a huge market and we're susceptible to that.
Absolutely. Yeah. When I hear it being called a disease, the first thing I think is, oh, capitalist pharmaceutical money-making machine. You tell them you have a disease. Oh, well, we have a cure. Oh, guess what? You have to buy it.
Now you're all sick.
Right? But if it's not a disease, there's nothing to fix. And nobody makes money when there's nothing to fix. What's your take, either personally or from what you've researched or reported, on complementary medicine, like acupuncture, for example, or Chinese herbs?
Yeah, I mean, I think that there's a place for all of that. I had an acupuncturist on the show who works with the endocrinologist, a double board certified endocrinologist I've had on the show a few times. And it's, you know, those things are sometimes harder to do randomized double placebo controlled trials on. And so we don't get the same gold standard, quote unquote, research on them. But yeah, they go back a long time and there is definitely evidence for them. And a lot of, you know, what I can say for sure, and science also shows on all parts of the spectrum, is that all of the symptomology is worse with stress. Like the underlying of stress is, you know, causes symptoms to be worse and it creates a vicious circle. So if anything that short circuits that stress response, and acupuncture is well known for that, as are some herbal things and adaptogens, then that makes sense that it's going to have this knock-on effect, you know, that it's going to help you with the symptomology too.
Yeah, it's interesting that you say that, because when I think of stress, I think of it as like general stress. Like, are you a stressed out person? Are you an anxious person? However, actually on a bike ride the other day, a friend of mine was saying that she just like, I don't know if it's like a chicken and egg thing. She said, I'm noticing that when my husband does something that annoys me, or when I get a stressful work email, that often precedes a hot flash by like a minute or so. It's not like a later in the day kind of thing. It's like immediate. So it's like, wow, is our body that quick to react to, like, is it cortisol?
Yeah. And what the link there is that when, so estrogen and progesterone, like your sex hormones, sort of help regulate that HPA axis, that stress response, right? That doesn't have the same regulators when the hormones start fluctuating and when estrogen declines. So cortisol is naturally, it's more of an elevated level all the time. It's harder to keep in check.
You're that's like a why, pot that's like at a simmer that could boil it.
Yeah. That's a great way to put it. And that's why like mindfulness actually works. They've done like studies that mindfulness is as effective as a lot of therapies for hot flashes, because it is like helping to tamp down that stress response. Again, which your hormones used to do more naturally. And that's one of the things, like, I do wish, you know, when people often ask, like, what do you wish you had known? Anxiety was the first thing that came up in my life. And it was just like, wake me up at 2 a.m. I feel like the world is ending anxiety, and just like free floating, non-specific, driving down the highway freaks me out, freezing on my mountain bike on a downhill that I had done a million times before. I wish I had known that was hormonal. Because that would have helped calm it down in and of itself. And I hear that on the show all the time. Like, women will say, I feel so much better just knowing what this is. Because then they can, and they're not just freaking out about themselves, right? They're like, okay, I know what this is. It's like knowing when you have PMS. You know what
I
mean?
That's exactly what I was thinking. Yeah. Like, I'm not good at keeping track, but like when I have an IUD now. But like, it would be like, I'd get my period and retroactively be like, oh, that's why I wanted to die. And I thought nothing would get better. Like
100%. You know, one day a month, I'd be like, well, I could just burn the house down. And then I get my period. I'm like, that's why. Okay.
Yeah. So yeah, what do you think? Like, I'm 44. As far as I know, I'm not perimenopausal yet, but I'm sure I will be soon. My oldest daughter is 11. Like, how are we going to be in my house, Celine? How are we going to do this?
Communication is a beautiful thing. I mean, it just is like just communicating. It is, you know, it's funny because they do call menopause puberty in reverse. And in a lot of ways it is. And a lot of the symptomology is very much the same, like the mood swings. So just understanding, communication, grace. I was in the same shoes, and it was, there was a lot of sharedness in it. Like, it can actually be okay. Like my daughter, once we had that language, I mean, we could talk in that language, you know, in our hormonal language, in our body's changing language. Yeah. And it can actually be a real bonding thing. So, I mean, you don't have to have doors slamming and everybody going crazy, you know, it can just be sort of a shared compassion can happen too, which transcends all that.
I love that. And I do deeply believe that our children come into our lives to be our teachers.
Oh, yeah.
And my older daughter in particular reminds me a lot of me. And so she's always showing me parts of myself that I may or may not want to see.
The hardest part.
So wild ride. So I'm like, okay, maybe as you say, this can be like a really sweet opportunity to connect and to know myself better and to give her the kind of compassion that I would like to give to myself or would have liked to give to my younger self.
Definitely.
Yeah. Yeah. Wow. Well, thank you. I appreciate that like air of hopefulness, because I feel like people paint this perimenopausal time as just a total shit show. And I hope you've given me a lot of hope. I hope that my listeners also feel that sense of hope.
It's a time, and I really believe this. I don't say things that I don't believe. It is a time of great power. Like, if you allow it to be, it is a transition. It is not a cave with a bear waiting for you at the back of it with no end. It is a tunnel. Sometimes it feels dark. There's always light at the end of it. But like, I encourage people to take the time to figure out who they want to be on the other side and to like what they want the next chapter of their lives to look like. Because you spend a lot of your life like building your career and building your family and building and trying to become what maybe you think the world wants you to be, and always maybe afraid of what the world thinks of you. And then you hit this place as you approach 50 that is magical, where you're like, I actually don't give a shit what you think. And it is amazing. And I encourage everybody to embrace that. And you have so much of your life ahead of you, and there's so many cool things. Even with this bikepacking thing, it's funny. Like, everybody is like, you're bikepacking? Because I was the last person that would carry a stitch more than I had to carry. I just was so obsessed with being as fast as I could and training. And oh my God, that looks terrible. Like, you're just riding with all that stuff. And joyfully, willfully putting that down as I went through menopause and been like, okay, I did all that. Like, what is next? Allowed me to express my athletic self in this whole new way that is equally satisfying and exciting. And if I hadn't gone through that, I wouldn't be here and I wouldn't be experiencing all these new things. And I hear that all the time from my audience. Like, so many of them just take up new things. They take up a new sport, or they try the same sport in a different way. And it's amazing. So it's, Don't allow it to be the end, because it's not. It's just a time to think about things and to maybe change some stuff in your life that maybe you should have changed anyway, and to take better care of yourself. And it's okay.
That's better awesome. Okay. I love that. Well, I cannot ask you any more questions, because that was like the perfect place to end. That was beautiful. Thank you for sharing that. Is there anything you want to add, though, that maybe you want people to know that I haven't asked you about?
No, I mean, that is really what I drill in all the time. When people are like, what is the one thing, I always say, live forward. If you're always looking back at what you used to be able to do or what you were, then you're missing everything that lies ahead of you that can be so great.
Amazing. So I know a lot of my listeners probably already know who you are. Some of them may be like, oh my gosh, who is this amazing person and where can I learn more about her? Where should people go when they want to find Celine after they listen?
Well, they should go to feistymenopause.com, because that is the home of my blog, of my podcast, and all the stuff that I am doing now. That is the best place to find me. They can follow me on Instagram. I'm at FitChick3, because I was the Fit Chick at Bicycling Magazine for 27 years. So I still carry that moniker. But most of the things that I do are at feistymenopause.com. And it's a great place for that kind of, we are a very positive place for this time of life.
Awesome. And I will put a link to Feisty Menopause in the show notes. Thank you so much for coming on, Celine. You were amazing.
Thank you.